Chapter 36, Let's Talk Turkey by Willie Snow Etheridge. 36, 3,300 miles and we're in Philadelphia. Knowing the Moline and us very well by now, it is not necessary to tell you, is it, that we didn't sail the next morning or the next. You suspected it all along, didn't you? Of all things, the bricks inside the boiler fell down. No doubt the blows the ship took in that gale loosened them. That left only one layer of brick, which was not sufficient to hold the heat. The flames would jump right out. The boiler had to be fixed before we could proceed to the States, but it couldn't be fixed until it had cooled enough for workmen to get to it, and that would take from 12 to 14 hours. This bit of news the chief engineer imparted to us just before we started down the gangplank for that quick look at Gibraltar. Now it need not be so quick. After the boiler cooled, bricklayers would come aboard and estimate the amount of damage that had been done and the quantity of bricks necessary to fix it. If the bricks could be obtained promptly, and the chief engineer thought they could be, then the bricklayers ought to be able to rebuild the boiler in 8 hours or so. When we had finished taking on oil, we would now have to find a place to drop anchor. We couldn't, of course, stay tied up to Shell Hulk 1 for repairs. When we started back to the ship at 10 o'clock that evening, we might find the Moline in a new berth. "Just look around the harbor for her," the chief engineer said casually. "She couldn't be far off." So with nothing to hurry us, the roommate, Mr. Big, and I simply wandered along the narrow, gaudy downtown streets of Gibraltar, crowded at the foot of the rock, looking for an English bicycle for Mr. Big. He had been arguing about a bicycle for at least a year, and when Mr. Big argues, it is a non-stop filibuster. And now he had fresh ammunition. Members of the crew had told him he could get an English bicycle here in this British outpost much more reasonably than in the United States. Indeed, Gibraltar is practically a free port, and many, many things are cheaper here than in any place I have ever seen. My only trouble was that I had spent almost all the roommate's money, not to mention my own $29, in the Great Bazaar in Istanbul. There was just enough left for a bicycle. Being broke didn't stop me, though, as we hailed from one bike shop to another, from enjoying the carnival air of Gibraltar. The streets were lined with Indian bazaars, the eastern variety, of course, not our woolly west, and slinky black tigers, woven or painted into flashy silken rugs, leaped at you from every other doorway. There were also many Spanish, French, and Italian shops brimming over with Spanish shawls and blinding rayon scarves and beaded bags and embroidered tablecloths and leather luggage and French perfume and everything. And music. The main street was crowded with dance halls and beer parlors with girl orchestras and bands to attract the heavy sailor and traffic. The music of one frequently overlapped the music of the next, like bands in a parade. I saw the roommate peering a bit wistfully through swinging doors of several of them, no doubt considering the advantages of a sailor's life versus a father's with a demanding son. We didn't look for a bicycle all the time, only until we had found and bought one. After that, we had to sit with the captain in patios in the sun to lunch on the veranda of the Rock Hotel high above the bay on baked swordfish and brains and boiled tomatoes and pancakes with jam and Malaga grapes, and to go to a movie in which Dick Powell, playing the role of an insurance salesman, announced to the glee of the Gibraltar audience that his company was as safe as the Rock of Gibraltar, and to do a number of other pleasant things. Then it was noon of the third day. The oil was in, the boiler rebuilt, and the crew all accounted for. We blasted away on our whistle, swished our tail at the rock, and headed for the wide Atlantic and home. More heavenly sunny days and evenings of canasta. And then one evening, right in the middle of the game, the radio operator, looking grave, came in with a slip of paper and handed it to the captain. A hurricane traveling north was several hundred miles to the south and west of us. The captain lost interest in the canasta game. and if truth be told, so did I. There was no immediate danger, of course, but if the hurricane continued north and we continued west, it would hit us. The captain pushed back his chair and, clutching the radiogram, giving the exact location of the center of the hurricane and the speed at which it was traveling, departed for the bridge to map out the place where the hurricane and the Moline would come to grips, if nothing happened to stop them. Captain Christie could do nothing to stop the hurricane, but he could do something about the Moline. At her maximum speed of 18 knots, he could not outrun a hurricane, but he could change her course so as to miss the heart of it. Every 2 hours for the next 48, new radiograms kept the captain informed as the hurricane's latest location and speed and directions, as to the hurricane's latest location and speed and direction of travel. And then word came that the scare was over, at least for us. The hurricane had veered sharply west into the Caribbean, smashing sections of Jamaica into shambles. Except for a few rain squalls, we felt no effect of it. We plowed steadily across the Atlantic, heading, we thought, for New York, but then word began to be circulated that New York was out. The word, known on a ship charmingly as Scuttlebutt, had it one day that we were landing in New Orleans, then no, not New Orleans, Baltimore, no, not Baltimore, Norfolk, no, not Norfolk, Boston, no, not Boston, Savannah, no, not Savannah, Philadelphia. Philadelphia struck me as most amusing. Who ever heard of anybody ever landing in Philadelphia? Why, it was inland. The next thing, Scuttlebutt would have us landing in Memphis or Little Rock. But, so help me, Philadelphia it was. 3 or 4 days out, the captain received orders to proceed to Philadelphia to take on gasoline for Turkey, no doubt for a Soconi vacuum of the friendly service, and then on to New York to load the rest of the cargo. The roommate, Mr. Big, and I were invited to stay on the ship until it reached New York and be properly welcomed home by Mr. Stephanides and other prudential officials, but the roommate said we would have to forego that pleasure. After all, fall was just a few days off, and we didn't want to take any chances on not getting home, as Sammy once mentioned, by Christmas Eve. Something the captain called channel fever set in when the crew sailed home, making them restless, excitable, and hospitable. A group invited the captain, roommate, Mr. Big, and me to come below to the crew's quarters to drink fish house punch and hear the orchestra that had been organized with 2 harmonica players and 3 drummers who beat those goatskin drums Mr. Big had bought in his Kinderon. The tiny captain was festive with strings of pink and white overtime slips. The guests and crew members lined up all available wall space, and Mr. Big, whose invitation had been addressed Mr. Junior, lay on his stomach in an upper bunk belonging to one of the Puerto Ricans, his gray eyes as bright as a cat's in the light of the one overhead electric bulb. The orchestra, consisting mostly of Puerto Ricans, was really terrific. Such rhythms as they coaxed with their bare hands out of those drums. Though I had no fish house punch, nor would you if you had heard the long and varied list of contents, Coca-Cola, brandy, gold, Fassa, gin, scotch, ginger ale, lemon squash, my head throbbed far into the night from the syncopated beat. The next morning, the Turkish lady gestured excitedly to the roommate and me to come forward. A little gray bird was sitting on the rail. Above us on the bridge was the captain, his binoculars held before his eyes. The captain is looking for the pilot ship now, said the roommate. Why is the pilot ship so important, I asked. Hell, if he doesn't find it, we might run up on the beach. Shortly afterward, a crew member bawls, there is the pilot station, boys. We have arrived. We are home, boys. We are home. Our blue and yellow flag, signaling for a pilot, had been flying for some little time, and now the pilot comes out, and we ease down to a snail's pace so he can catch the lowered rope ladder and climb up to the deck. He will pilot us up the Delaware River, which I am informed is a river we must go up if we are to reach Philadelphia. Mr. Big takes down the pilot flag and folds it carefully. There's no doubt in my mind that he ran it up, too, though I was packing and didn't see it go up. But he does practically everything on the ship now. It really seems silly to have a pilot for the Delaware River with him on board. Darkness catches us before we reach Philadelphia. I felt all along it would. I'm still not convinced Philadelphia is on this river. We turn off our engines and anchor off Wilmington, Delaware. By night, from the river, it is a beautiful sight. Thousands of red, green, and yellow lights guarding the skyline beneath the cocked eye of a waning moon. A morning, even by 4:30, when we are rudely awakened to prepare for the arrival of immigration and customs officials, the lights and the moon have faded, and in their places stand stark scaffolding of steel and towers of concrete. Cracking, I can scarcely believe it either, but that's what my man says, plants and oil refineries. Soon, our engines begin to turn, and thinking quite naturally that if we are ever to get to Philadelphia, this is the time, I go up on deck to watch our approach thither. But scarcely are we well underway when we turn sharply into the right-hand bank of the Delaware, massed for acres with oil storage tanks. Don't tell me this is a city of brotherly love, I say to the roommate. No, this is the tank farm of the Shell Standard Oil Company. It is 19 miles south of Philadelphia. You don't mean to tell us we're landing here? Yes, this is it. I've just heard. Of course, this is no proper place to land after what I like to think of as a Mediterranean cruise. Welcoming offspring and friends and telegrams can't find you. It turns out no welcoming offspring or friends or telegrams are trying to find us. The brother of the Turkish woman finds her, though, and their hysterical reunion after 30 years separation dissolves me in tears, too. And the customs officer finds us, those fellers are everywhere, and after one glance at our declaration on which the roommate has painstakingly set down every copper jug and every china vase, he demands, "Can't you lump all these things together? There's no need to string them out like this." After that, nothing about that comes through clearly, except a little scene many hours later. It is early evening and we are in Philadelphia. We made the 19 miles in a long black car. Again, I have a feeling it is a Cadillac, hired graciously by the Prudential Lines, and are waiting on the platform for the Cincinnati Limited, which in spite of its name will carry us to Louisville. The roommate and Mr. Big are sitting on our luggage, and the Turkish drum at their feet. Their faces are flushed and running with perspiration. Their shirts are sopping. The thermometer has been panting close to 100 all day, and the humidity has been terrific. "It's hotter over here than it was over there," pronounces the roommate, and he and Mr. Big, who are so eager to reach home, grin ruefully at each other. End of chapter 36. Let's talk turkey, and that is the end of the book.